Thank you very much. This thing working, yes, yes. I would like to thank the organizers for the nice invitation and for the great idea of having a workshop joined between physicists and mathematicians, because many of the topics that we are discussing, mathematicians are an invaluable asset that you need in order to be able to address the problems. So many of the papers that I actually wrote are in collaboration with mathematicians. So I decided to write about flux compactifications. Many talks were about flux compactifications. And to talk about the things that I find exciting about flux compactifications, I ran into 60 transparencies. So it seems that I'm pretty excited. So please stop me when things are too easy. I would like to have everybody at a common level, or slow me down if I'm going too fast. So I would like to say first that I've been very sloppy with references. So please don't feel offended if I don't reference, because I've been really very sloppy. So as I say, the goal is to discuss flux compactifications, cosmology, and the standard model of elementary particles. I will be discussing compactifications of the weakly coupled as well as the strongly coupled heterotic string on complex non-Kähler manifolds with torsion. These compactifications are characterized by the fact that fluxes, which means non-vanishing expectation values of tensor fields, appear. Fluxes, as you now probably know by now, imply that many of the Mohr fields of the internal manifold can be stabilized. And this brings us one step closer to determining the ground state of string theory and to make predictions that are concrete enough to compare with the standard model of elementary particles and hopefully with new recent cosmological data. So let me start with my favorite model, which is the simplest case that appeared first in the literature, because even if it's just a toy model, it illustrates the basic idea of what a flux compactification does for you. So what I would like to do is to consider M3, and I would like to consider M3 compactified on a manifold that looks like this, that is conformally Calabi-Yau. So here we've got our warp factor that depends only on the internal coordinates that I called Y. GMN is a Calabi-Yau fourfold, which means I'm compactifying to three dimensions. And I'm demanding an n equal to 2 supersymmetry in D equal to 3. Of course, this metric doesn't determine the manifold completely. What we can have is we can have deformations of this metric. We can have deformations of the complex structure of the manifold, which will give rise to H31 complex scalars, which are called Ti, or we can deform the Kähler structure of the manifold, which will give rise to H11 scalars in the lower dimensional theory. So the question is, how does the concrete form of the action that I would like to consider look like? The concrete form of the action is, I start with 11-dimensional supergravity, which contains our Einstein term. It contains a fourth form, which are potentials, free form C. It contains a Chern-Simons term, and it has got this higher order correction, which you can deduce from type 2A string theory by computing a full graviton scattering amplitude, or you can deduce it directly in 11 dimensions by using gauge invariance. So what we see from this action here is that, suppose that I don't have any membrane sources, the equation of motion for the tensor field F takes this form here. What I can do now for you is just to take the simple equation of motion and integrate it over the internal 8-dimensional manifold. What I see from there is what we know as the Tedford cancellation condition, namely it links the F with F term, the flux over the internal manifold, to an integral over X8. And for manifolds which have a vanishing first Chern class, this is given by the Euler character of the internal manifold. So what do we see from here? What we see from here is that, suppose we neglect this higher order correction in our 11-dimensional supergravity, or M3 action, I should say, what we see is that the fluxes are equal to zero, so FHS is equal to zero because the term would not appear, which means we run into the modulus state problem because we're discussing a conventional Calabi-Yau compactification. However, the situation is of course different. Let me go back here to my transparency. The situation is of course different if you take the X8 into account because you have no choice. Once the X8 is there, you compactify on a manifold with an Euler character that is different from zero, you have no choice, but the fluxes have to be taken into account for consistency. So what this means for us is that we can make predictions for the coupling constants, for the moduli fields Ti and Ki. So let's see why this is so. So the fluxes that are different from zero are not arbitrary, but are constrained by supersymmetry. The basic equation that you have to solve is that the variation of the gravitino is equal to zero. So the action that we had a moment ago is invariant under supersymmetry transformations. The relevant equation, if you're looking for a supersymmetric configuration, is that the variation of the gravitino has to be equal to zero. The other two equations are kind of trivial. But this equation, we can evaluate this equation. So let me just tell you what comes out of it. It tells me that the first zero component of the flux, I'm using complex coordinates because I'm dealing with a Calabi-Yau fourfold. So it tells me that the first zero component and the 3-1 component of the flux have to be equal to zero by supersymmetry. Furthermore, we see that the only non-vanishing component of the flux is the 2-2 component, which means the component of the flux that has got two holomorphic and two anti-holomorphic indices and satisfies the permittivity condition where J is the Kähler form of the Calabi-Yau fourfold. Okay, these constraints were derived by supersymmetry, and then Gukokoff and Zitten realized that there are some interactions responsible for these constraints, which just means that we can derive this from superpotentials. So they saw that there are two types of superpotentials. One they call W for the complex structure moduli, which is this one here, and the other one for the Kähler structure moduli fields. If you're dealing with a manifold, so tell me if I'm going too fast. I'm assuming that this is kind of, well, more or less well-known subject. So if you're dealing with a spacetime where the cosmological constant is equal to zero, then supersymmetry demands that the derivatives here are equal to zero. Let me define the derivative specifically in the next transparency. So this derivative contains just an ordinary derivative of the potential of the superpotential plus a derivative of the Kähler potential multiplied by W. So what supersymmetry demands is that this derivatives have to be equal to zero, and our superpotentials have to be equal to zero. So what we can easily see, so this derivative, of course, means the derivative with respect to our moduli fields. So what we can easily see is, take, for example, this condition, W equal to zero. What we see is that the zero-form component of a flux has to be equal to zero. A little more work. Taking the derivative of W with respect to the complex structure moduli, what we see is that the 1-3 component is equal to zero. And the same story to derive the permittivity condition. So these are conditions that are imposed on the fluxes, which means the fluxes are not arbitrary. So Gukokoff and Zitten more or less guessed those superpotentials, but they didn't derive them. But you can go ahead and take your line element that you had at the beginning, take your action, and this is what Hag and Lewis did, and do the Kaluza-Klein compactification. And they arrived at this explicit form of the action and derived the form of the superpotentials for us. The K that appears here is the complete Kähler potential, which contains the part for the complex structure, and the part for the Kähler structure. So what we see from this form of writing, what we see from here is that this scalar potential is always positive, and it has got a minimum when this derivative here are equal to zero. So we have got a nice solution to the equations of motion. And if you look a little bit closer to it, what this means is that the fluxes that solve the equations of motion have to be self-dual. What does it mean? So you can go ahead, just take your star of the flux and see which fluxes are self-dual, which fluxes are anti-self-dual. And you see there are several possibilities. There is the two component, which is primitive, that we discussed a moment ago, but is compatible with supersymmetry. But then there are other two components which are not supersymmetric, which is rather kind of exciting, or it's unconventional, because what you see from here is that you can turn on a flux, say a 0-4 component, which breaks with the symmetry, and at the same time, the cosmological constant is equal to zero because, as I say, the potential vanishes. So let me quickly summarize. But easy example. So what we have seen is that in M3 compactifications with fluxes, find several features that are rather interesting from the phenomenological point of view. You can stabilize moduli fields. You just derived a potential for the moduli fields, which is usually zero for ordinary Calabi-Yau compactifications. You can break supersymmetry while preserving a vanishing cosmological constant, which is again an interesting result. And we can have warp space times, which might be one of the few solutions of the hierarchy problem. A similar scenario appeared, of course, in the type DB theory. The conditions for unbroken supersymmetry were derived right after we derived the M3 constraint by the Zalatoussere. And Giddings, Katcher, and Polchinski realized that one can derive this from a superpotential. In this case, G is a freeform which has got two components here. And the superpotential takes this form here. The scalar potential is of no scale type. What we also see from here is that the index I that I wrote down here runs only over the complex structure moduli. In other words, we have no potential for the Kähler structure moduli. However, KKLT realized that if you include non-perturbative effects, you can derive a potential for the Kähler structure modeling. However, this is not what I would like to address here. I don't want to discuss neither M-theory, compactified to three dimensions, nor the type B theory. What I'm interested in is in getting to a phenomenologically realistic model, which means I would like to discuss the hedonic string. So let me start discussing the weakly hedonic string. And the question that I would like to address is, can we get a phenomenologically more interesting scenario where our world is four-dimensional instead of three-dimensional in the context of the hedonic string? The answer is yes, through a series of duality transformations. These duality transformations were discussed by Michael Schulz this morning. So what we see is that we arrive at specific backgrounds that are interesting both from the phenomenological and mathematical point of view. So mathematicians are rather excited about this complex manifold, which are non-Kähler and have torsion, because many theorems of algebraic geometry just don't go through. So they are really kind of keen to understand this type of compactification. So first question I would like to address, what are the constraints in a similar way as we started with M3 or we had in the type 2B theory, what are the constraints on supersymmetry? So what we know is that for the hedonic, what we have got is a three-form H, and the full action in the 10-dimensional string frame is invariant under this type of supersymmetry transformations, where this gamma here is just a commutator of gamma matrices. So we have got our Gravitino, Gluino, and our Dilatino equation. So let me not discuss at all the gluing equation. It's an equation which is rather hard to solve, and our colleagues at University of Pennsylvania are doing a rather good job, all time collaborators, in discussing how this equation can be solved. So I will not be addressing this equation at all. So here we've got our constraint shown supersymmetry. And of course, a supersymmetric configuration is again a configuration where the variation with respect to the supersymmetry, which doesn't transform under supersymmetry, which means it satisfies an equation like this. Of course, if you look back at your supersymmetry transformations, you see h equal to 0, setting the covariant derivative of the epsilon, which contains the Christoffel connection, and phi equal to constant is a solution. A not interesting solution, because it's just a ordinary Calabi-Yau threefold, and we're running into the moduli space problem. The more interesting solution is, of course, the case where pH is different from 0, where you arrive at the troubles that you're dealing with complex manifolds, which include torsion. So let's see what happens in this case. So the generalization to the case where the H flux is different from 0 was worked out by the authors around at the end of the 80s, but people didn't realize so much that it would lead to a solution of the moduli space problem. So those manifolds kind of lost interest for a while, and they came back just recently. So what we see from let's have a look again at our Gravitino supersymmetry transformation. We see that the freeform H appears in the form of a torsion, and that I can define a covariant derivative which, besides the ordinary Christoffel connection, contains the freeform H as a torsion. And we can define a covariantly constant spinner epsilon. In terms of this covariantly constant spinner, I will be able to construct a complex structure, which means I can construct a tensor, which looks this way here. Again, this is a commutator of two gamma matrices, which is H covariantly constant. At the end of the day, this means that our manifold is non-Kähler. It squares to minus 1, which means it's getting to be a complex structure. And what we see is that the Niesenhof tensor, taking this object into account, you can do a kind of easy calculation using Fitzgerald arrangements. What you see is that the Niesenhof tensor vanishes. In other words, you just showed from supersymmetry that your manifold is complex, and you have found your complex structure. So what we can do is we can now go ahead and contract with a metric to construct the fundamental form which characterizes the manifold. Since I said it's a complex manifold, I can introduce complex coordinates and complex indices. So again, I'm dealing with a 1-1 form, which, for the case where the manifold is Kähler, dj is closed, it would be the Kähler form. But as I say, in this case, the manifold is not Kähler, so it's a fundamental form which is not the Kähler form of the manifold. Indeed, in this case, the dj will be proportional to a derivative of the warp factor. So what we have just seen is that the constraints we derived from M3, the analog of this constraints that we had from M3 at the very beginning in our toy model, for the heterodic take, for the weakly coupled heterodic take, this form here, where J is the fundamental form of the manifold. Again, what you can do is you can more or less guess the form of the superpotential in the same way as Gukhoff and Wooten did. And what you see is that the superpotential of this form here, where H is the real ordinary free form of the heterotic, plus IDJ, where this DJ is, of course, not different from 0, because you're dealing with a non-Kähler manifold, is the form of the superpotential. So this DJ, as I said a moment ago, is proportional to the warp factor. Omega is the holomorphic free form, so one can show, and indeed I think it's shown explicitly in the paper by Strominger, that these manifolds are always characterized by a holomorphic 3-0 form in a similar way as a Calabi-Yau manifold. So, consequences, our W reproduces the supersymmetry constraint. We just derived a potential which stabilizes the complex structure moduli fields and some of the Kähler structure moduli fields. For example, I won't get into this example. We discussed this in one of our papers. We can stabilize the radius of the module of the internal manifold, and it's going to be determined in terms of the fluxes. Yes. Oh, that's a very, very good question. That's a very good question. We are thinking about this. So how to even define moduli fields very carefully in the mathematical sense. It's a very good point. I know that I didn't know the answer because I'm thinking about it. So thanks for asking. So one thing that we cannot stabilize in this way is the dilaton. Well, and there were collaborators in Berlin who stabilized this through non-perturbative effects, Gugino condensation. But I would like to use the opportunity to address this issue in a theory that I consider more fundamental, which is M-theory. So M-theory compactified on S1 mod Z2, which people called heterotic M-theory, or the strongly coupled heterotic string. So now that we have got the constraints from supersymmetry, the question is, can you construct a concrete example? And here's where the dualities of Michael Schultz come in. So suppose we would like to make a duality to the type 2B theory. So we will be constructing a model of the SO32 heterotic string. First was discussed by the Southosphere, and later on by Katrin and Keshav, it was more elaborate. So suppose you take the SO32 heterotic string on a manifold like this. You take the orbifold limits of K3. Then the metric takes this direct product form here. So these are our coordinates of T4. Here we've got our T2. And it's a well-studied compactification. You know the Betti numbers. You know the Euler character. So the topology, everything is known. And you know that the Euler character is equal to zero. If I now would like to turn on flux, you see the same thing that Michael showed this morning. What you see is that instead of having a direct product, you see that you do have a work product here, where the T2 is no longer just T2 and T4 are no longer a direct product, but you have got a T2 fiber running over a K3 base. A and B are, by the way, just constants that you can fix through the Dirac quantization condition. So how do you construct, what's the easiest way to construct, or before I say that, what you can do is, again, go ahead and compute the Betti numbers of this manifold. So in general, for non-Kähler manifolds, Hodge numbers don't tell you anything. What you have to compute for non-Kähler manifolds, for the topological invariants, are the Betti numbers, because the Hodge decomposition just doesn't go through. So that's something I learned from mathematicians. So you can go ahead, compute the Betti numbers of your manifold, and compare with what I had a moment ago, and you see that the topology of your manifold has changed. The Betti numbers of the manifold have changed. Nevertheless, the Euler character of the manifold is still zero. I was about to say that you do dualities to the model, that KST model. You cannot no longer say the Betti number, I don't know which one, take B3, is no longer the sum of the Hodge numbers H1, 3, so they no longer characterize the manifold. Okay, no, normally you can just say B3 is the sum of H1, 2 plus H3, 0 plus, and so on and so forth. So this doesn't tell you any information for this type of manifold. There are still cohomology groups, but the splitting, I think the splitting, yeah. Okay, so coming back to the question that Mike was asking, how can this be constructed? So you take type 2B theory, Betti number, first Betti number is equal to 0 on this manifold here. You can go in several ways. So you can go to two key dualities on the two torus and an S duality which invertes the coupling. You arrive at the non-warped SO32, excuse me, adiabatic string, or you can go then this way here, turn on the fluxes, which gives you a work product, alias this is the KST model, catch your first entry ready, go ahead to your two T dualities and an S duality, and you arrive at a manifold, at the metric of your model, which takes this form here, the fibered product over a K3 base. So far, so good. So what we have is the metric of our manifold. Once I have the metric, I can use my supersymmetry constraints to tell you what the form of the tree form is. So we know supersymmetry tells me that the tree form flux is related to the metric of our manifold in this way here. I can write it in components in this way here if I want. So J, the fundamental form, is related to the metric in this way here. So I just use this equation to construct my tree form, and it looks in this way here. So there's no kind of mystery behind it. So let me conclude about what I was going to say about the weakly coupled tetraedric string. So what we see in the weakly coupled tetraedric string is that turning on edge flux leads to phenomenologically as well as mathematically interesting manifolds that are complex and non-killer and have torsion. The induced superpotential derived from supersymmetry constraints takes this form here. You can use it to determine the complex structure modeling, but only some of the killer structure modeling are determined. We had a couple of follow-up papers where we discussed, or I think it was one paper, where we discussed the extension of this to the E8 cross E8 tetraedric string and to manifolds where the Euler character is different from zero. Because we were first worried that the number of generations was going to be equal to zero if the Euler character is equal to zero, but we learned in the process that this only holds if you embed the spin connection into the gauge connection, which is not what you can do in the case where you're discussing non-killer manifolds. All right? So things that are on our wish list, so to say, that I would like to work in the near future are constructing more realistic E8 cross E8 models. We'd like to do Mike's vacuum statistic for the heroic theory, which still hasn't been done, and I should have been done it. It should have been done a long time ago, but I still didn't get to it. And we need a better control of the mathematics of this manifold and understand better the vector bundles, which I understood is a hard, very hard business. So the question is, how do we determine the dilaton of this manifold? And as I say, I would like to do this in the context of the strongly coupled tetraedric string. There's just no potential. Flat. Yes. Yeah, let me go back. Just hold on a second. I don't have what? Yes. Okay, so what we did is to use... There are constraints on the field. So what we did is to map this this story came from the type 2B theory. Through duality transformations of the potential from the type 2B theory, we know that in the type 2B theory, in relative supersymmetry, the fluxes have to be imaginary self-dual. So using the fact that the fluxes have to be imaginary self-dual, you get the constraint on the H flux in terms of the fundamental form. So which means you have a constraint fundamental form in terms of the H flux. But I still cannot give you a mathematical, rigorous definition of what the model fields are. But there is a link there between the geometry and the flux. Good point. Thank you. All right, so let me come to the strongly coupled quadratic theory. So current astronomical data, like the WMAP data or supernova observations or the Hubble telescope data, are in nice agreement with the dark energy of our universe generated by a positive cosmological tungsten. So modern theoretical physics faces the challenge of finding realistic non-supersymmetric vacuum with a positive vacuum energy. So for many years, there were in the literature no-go theorems that told us that the theory of space couldn't be realized in string theory. However, with recent progress in non-perturbative string theory, these no-go theorems were turned over, so they no longer hold, and people were able to derive the theory of space in string theory, so like KKLT, but we will use a different approach to derive the theory of space in string theory. So KKLT used the type 2B theory, and as I say, I'm kind of ready to go for phenomenology with string theory, which is why I'm sticking to the hadronic theory. And my goal is to consider M3 on a Calabi-Yau threefold, so I would like to turn off the torsion for now, otherwise my life will be too difficult. Let me turn off the torsion and consider the hadronic M3 on a Calabi-Yau threefold times S1 mod Z2, alias hadronic M3. So what I would like to do is I would like to search for the pseudo vacua in this theory. So what we know is that in the hadronic M3 there are several types, so you know you do have two boundaries. You have got your S1 mod Z2, which means you have got two boundaries, which are fixed points of this Z2 action. So you have got the visible boundary and you have got the hidden boundary. And both of them interact through membrane instantons. So what does it mean? And it's something that you cannot neglect, you cannot just it's there, it's an interaction that is there, so you have to take it into account. So what it is a membrane that wraps the S1 interval and a cycle sigma 2 of the internal Calabi-Yau 3. So we have got an open membrane instanton which will break supersymmetry, we will see this a little later on, spontaneously giving us metastable minima with a positive scalar potential. So this is one type of non-perturbative effect. However, we shall see that there's a second type of non-perturbative effect, which is Gugino condensation on the hidden boundary. But before I do that, let me tell you what components of the fluxes we are going to be taking into account. First of all, if you take a hadronic M3 and we compactify it on this Calabi-Yau threefold, what we see is that we obtain an n equal to 1 supergravity in 4 dimensions, which is by supersymmetry characterized by a gauge kinetic function. We do have our scalar potentials and we have got our superpotentials. And as I say, there are several types of fluxes. I would like to, this type of fluxes, this is the 4 form that we do have in M3. So the last index here indicates the orbifold index, which means the S1 mod Z2 index. that if I set it to 0, I'm dealing with a 4 form. So notice that this appears only in the strongly coupled hydraulic string. This component is not present in the weakly coupled hydraulic string. And I would like to turn off the components which have a 1 at the end, which are the components appearing in the weakly coupled hydraulic string, just to make my life easier to have a starting point somewhere. So what this means, if I take only this component of the flux into account, is that the internal manifold is conformal to a Calabi-Yau threefold. And we will, was there a question? No. And we will be able to stabilize the so-called universal Mobley fields, which are the volume of the internal Calabi-Yau. There are, of course, axions that come from different components of the tree form in M3, and the length of the interval, or the volume, the normalized volume of the open membrane instanton, which depend on L. L is the length of the interval. So when I tell you, so the dilaton that I was talking a moment ago, that I wasn't able to stabilize in the context of the weakly coupled hydraulic string, I now would like to show you that I'm able to stabilize this in the context of a strongly coupled hydraulic string. So this corresponds just to the size of the S1 mod V2 interval. They would have been projected out. Yes, in the weakly coupled limit, they are gone. In the weakly coupled hydraulic limit, you just have no fourth one.
Well,
right?
But if you just go down in S1 mod V2, you project it down.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
So you say it's not projected
there? No. No, it stays there. Oh, he was asking whether it is projected out, but it's not. It only appears in the strongly coupled limit. It's a component that is in the bulk. Okay, so what we see, what is also exciting, we get this as an extra bonus, is that we are able to take charge scalar fields, which are in the 27 representation of E6, and show that at the minimum of the potential, this charge scalars indeed get an expectation value. This is kind of rather exciting because in string theory, people were worried about getting, they're playing kind of the role of the Higgs fields that later on will give masses to the elementary particles of the standard model. And people were trying to give expectation values to this charge scalars for a very, very long time. So this is an extra bonus which appears when we consider the strongly coupled hydraulic string. So luckily, the ingredients that we need in order to do our calculations were worked out by a couple of our colleagues, so the Penn State Group and Murpratz and Salina worked this out. And what we need in order to derive the scalar potential is, of course, the Kähler potentials, which take this form here. B of V is the second Chern class on the visible boundary. And we need superpotentials. What are S and T? I defined them a moment ago. So let me go back. They are the volume. So they are the volume of the Calabi-Yau. T is the volume of the open membrane instanton. I restrict myself to the simplest example, H11 equal to 1. So I don't take anything else for now into account, except the charge scalars. Okay? Complex structure moduli, they are complex structure moduli. Are, complex. You can, if you take the H wedge omega into account, which I did throw out, remember that the H wedge omega that I had in the weakly completed radix thing, this will stabilize for you the complex structure model I, but I'm not taking it into account, just for simplicity. I'm ignoring it because of simplicity. I have to start somewhere. But you can take it into account. Okay? They don't bother me, so they go alone on their own way, kind of. The difficult thing for me was kind of, the interesting thing was for me to see how the dilaton gets stabilized and how we can get expectations for charge scatters, but I agree. The next thing, the last of my transparencies will be a wish list. We can take all the other components into account. We can take the torsion into account. We can take also the other H wedge, what was it, H plus IDJ wedge omega potential into account. Yes, that's one of the next goals. So, super potentials. You have got contributions. So, I'm not taking the super potentials that I had for the H wedge omega into account. I'm just taking the super potential for my charge scalars. Lambdas are the Yukawa couplings plus non-perturbative super potentials. So what are these non-perturbative super potentials? There are two types of non-perturbative effects. As I said, the open membrane instantons, you have to take both ones into account. Boundaries interact via open membrane instantons, and they tend to repel each other via open membrane instantons. While Gaugino condensation on the hidden boundary, so you have got a strongly coupled gauge theory on the hidden boundary because you can show that the volume of your Calabi-Yau manifold shrinks, becomes smaller on the hidden boundary so that you get a strongly coupled gauge theory of the hidden boundary. Okay? So two types of non-perturbative effects, open membrane instantons and Gluino condensation. So we know how the superpotentials for this object look like. We, of course, don't know how the Safian looks like, which depends on the complex structure modeling. But we know the exponential dependence. So T, again, let me remind you, was the field that corresponds to the volume of the open membrane instanton. So you can also, you know how the superpotential for Gaugino condensation looks like. It looks in this way here. I defined the gamma. Basically, it depends again on the length of your interval. In this way here, so it depends on S and T. So as we see, everything depends on the length of the interval. I've got my open membrane instanton, which depends on T from the length of the interval. I do have my Gluino condensation, which depends on S and T. And again, here is implicitly the L dependence. So what I can do for you is to look carefully how the L dependence of the superpotentials looks like. And happily, the L dependence of both superpotentials just goes in the opposite way. While the open membrane instantons tend to make the boundaries repel, the two fixed planes repel, the Gaugino condensation goes in the opposite way. It tends them, make them to attract. So what we can expect by just looking at the form of the superpotential is that we can, when we compute the scalar potential, be lucky and indeed obtain a nice minimum for our scalar potential. So due to this opposite behavior, as a function of L, we may expect that the scalar potential has a non-trivial minimum. And you can now go ahead and compute explicitly, as I told you, we have the Taylor potential, we have got the superpotential, so we can go ahead and supersymmetry determines for you how the scalar potential looks like. You go ahead and compute the scalar potential. Superpotential is what I'm talking about, the scalar potential now. Oh, I'm looking at the it was a motivation. Okay, it's a motivation for kind of arguing that we may expect. I'm looking at the real part of the superpotential. Yeah, so you're right. You're asking about the imaginary part about the actions, right? Yeah. I was going to head for the scalar potential in a second. So you have got the dw square, and it's real.
The open membrane.
Yes. Non-perturbative. They are
non-perturbative.
And when I shrink the size of the interval. Yes. They are, well, I believe I watched in sometimes, yes. Why should I trust? Repeat the question again. You would like to?
So let's think about one of these open membrane instances.
Yes.
Contribution, you say it's exponential minus the
yes.
size of the interval.
Yes.
So what happens when the size goes to zero? What's the formula?
Let me think about this. Let me think about this, and I can't tell you offhand. Let me figure that part. Let's talk about this later.
She's making a simple argument based on the idea that she's trying to make a simple argument based on the idea that if there's something like a pole at zero, you would like to see that. But because those two, well, she doesn't know, right? These are not the things, these are the things that go between the two then.
Yeah. I believe there are watched in some sense, but I was going to talk to you. So, okay. Because there's still one thing that I would like to tell you once I'm done with this. Hopefully, I will have time, which is we were able to get inflation in hydrotic entropy. So you can actually go ahead now and do the calculation of your scalar potential. It has a nice minimum, so I just plotted the minimum. It's a metastable minimum. I just plotted it in a particular region. What you see is that supersymmetry is broken spontaneously by Gluino condensation, and you're able to get the supersymmetry scale as low as the TV scale. So, of course, it will depend on what the gauge theory on the hidden boundary is, because you know that the Gaugino condensation depends on the dual Coxeter number of the gauge theory that is on the hidden boundary. So, but you can get as low as the TV scale, which kind of sounds exciting. As I had mentioned before, the scalar field CI get non-vanishing expectation values at this minimum, which also I think is a very exciting result, because this was a problem for string theory for a long time. So let me just in the last couple of minutes. So what I consider rather interesting here in the way we are breaking supersymmetry, as opposed to KKLT, which throw in anti-distributions to break supersymmetry and to get the serial space, is that you can actually do the calculation and compute what the scale of supersymmetry breaking is. So you are not putting in anything by hand. There are interactions between between boundaries that you cannot neglect. There is the Gugino condensation on the hidden boundary that you cannot neglect. You're not putting anything by hand. These things are just there, and they will give you this nice potential for the dilaton. Of course, as I said, our next goal will be to turn on the remaining flux components. But let me just, in the last couple of minutes, discuss something that Axel will probably discuss next Tuesday in very much detail, and which I'm rather excited about, which is inflation in M3. So what we, since we were able to derive the Sitter space in M3, our question is, can we describe inflation in M3? And the answer is yes, we found a way on how to realize inflation in M3. So some proposals have appeared in the literature which are not completely satisfactory. They require a fair amount of fine-tuning. The two slow roll parameters that we need in order to get nice single-field inflation, which are the ones here, are usually just way too high. So what proposals do we have so far in the literature? What has been discussed in the literature is something that is called new inflation, where the Sitter expansion phase has a scale factor. So this is a scale factor of the Friedman-Robinson-Walker universe, which, yes. Four. I'm compactifying M3 on a six-dimensional Calabi-Yau times S1 mod C2. So it's very phenomenological. Okay. So two main examples have been discussed in the literature. People were trying to get a very flat potential for the inflaton in brain, anti-brain inflation. Again, what is not very satisfactory is that the eta parameter is around 1, and they don't have a very nice kind of exit from inflation. Another proposal that people tried in the literature, and which looks kind of natural in to try to realize this in string theory, is to use to try to find power law inflation, because you've got this nice exponentials that I was discussing for the potentials that I was discussing a moment ago. So power law inflation, in power law inflation, what you have is potential, which is an exponential potential for the inflaton, which looks in this way here. The scale factor scales with a power law T to the P, and your eta parameter and your epsilon parameter are constants, which look in this way here. So in order, as I said, to get a nice model for inflation, what you need is that these two parameters have to be very small. In other words, your P needs to be very big. Since these parameters are constants, you won't find an exit from inflation. However, you can do it in M3. And it's something, as I say, Axel will discuss this in more detail, that is called assisted inflation. So what you basically do is you take, instead of taking just one, what you do is, instead of taking just the boundaries and interactions between the boundaries described by open membranes, you put a set of M5 brains. These M5 brains are close enough so that we can neglect the interactions with the boundaries through open membranes, but they are not so close that kind of we have to take non-abelian theories into account. So what we have is these M5 brains interact through open membrane instantons, which will repel both M5 brains. And what we see is through the stack of M5 brains, we get a model that is called assisted inflation, where it's a couple of exponentials. Instead of being just one single exponential, we have got for each interaction between the enfeistments, one exponential, which means that your P depends on the number of enfeistments. And a very, very mild fine-tuning, where I just put in the number of enfeistments, will guarantee that my epsilon and my eta parameter are actually small to guarantee inflation in N3, which for us was a very, very exciting result. So what happens then is you've got your two enfeistments. The enfeistments will start repelling each other. We said membrane instantons tend to kind of repel the enfeistments. And once the distance between the enfeistments is large enough so that they interact with the boundary, Gugino condensation will kick in. And at that point, your enfeistments will be stabilized, and you get a nice, graceful exit from inflation, which we think is a very nice result. And I think Axel will discuss this next week in more detail, how we did the calculation. So the list of open, so I do have 5 minutes, but I thought the list of open questions is so long, and we have got so many questions that still need to be addressed in the context of hydrodynamic compactifications from the math point of view, from the physics point of view, so that I just would like to stop here.